The following is a conversation with Chris Lewis, blogger, charity owner, and businessman. This conversation is about cancer and all the overwhelming challenges and potential discrimination that come with the diagnosis, inequalities, death, the impact of COVID, and importance of time and communication, and Chris' unique and inspiring story. Chris worked in the garment industry, helping to create a multi-million pound business from scratch. In 2007, he was diagnosed with mantle cell lymphoma, undergoing intensive chemotherapy and stem cell transplantation. He has survived the extreme treatments and side effects to become one of the most respected voices in the subject of improving lives of people affected by cancer across the world. His website, Chris Cancer Community, has won numerous awards since 2012 and was voted UK Health Blog of the Year. In 2017, he co-founded an innovative charity called SimPal, giving free phones and prepaid SIM cards to people affected by cancer poverty, the only organization in the world doing this incredible work. A sincerest thank you goes out to Chris for his valuable time. And now, enjoy this conversation with Chris Lewis.
Lovely. Nice to meet you.
Nice to finally meet you in person or virtually.
Yeah.
And thank you for your time. Really appreciate it.
Now, listen, I understand the issues, Nico, right? And you're a great voice. You know, I watch what you guys do. I have an affinity with EBMT, you know. I know the people there, and I love working with the organisation. I think it's very forward-thinking, and you know, it knows what the problems are, and it's not shy to ask, you know, to try and solve these problems. And it's an honour for me, really, to you know, to work with you guys, because it's the subject is very close to my heart, of course. And my work, which I do, is all about now improving the lives of people affected by cancer in general, but obviously specifically for me with transplant and that sort of work. So, you know, it's what I spend all my life doing. And so to help these days, you know, the world's changed, Nico. I'm sure you're very much aware. We've all changed. It's all changed. And the way we communicate, I mean, it was changing anyway, you know, pre-COVID. The world was changing. We knew about that. EBMT knew about that. But I think what COVID has done has accelerated that change. I believe it's change that is required. I believe it was required long ago, but for many things, by the way, not just health, but, you know, for saving the planet and all of that situation. These are changes that have been needed, and it's only like a global situation that's happened that hopefully makes us think differently about the way we work and how impactful our work is. You know, a lot of people work very hard, certainly in the cancer sector, but actually the results don't show any improvement on the whole for the effort that's put in. So that tells me that we're not doing the thing in the right way. So, you know, it's all very well everyone going home and saying they worked hard, and they can be very proud of that. But if at the end of the day we haven't achieved anything by that hard work, I think there's other things we can do with our time. Does that make sense?
It makes absolutely sense. And this brings me to my first impression I had when I first met you via Twitter, I think 2 years ago at the EBMT. What you said is that kind of change, or the expectation of change, or try to do some change. When I follow you, it's always accompanied by some kind of anger, you know, that's necessary to see what's lacking or where the problems are, and then to handle and to really try to make things happen. And maybe my first question is, what makes you most angry today about maybe cancer care or problems in general?
Cancer care, Nico, to be honest with you, it's a global problem. You know, these days, cancer, we can't just look at it in isolation in one country or another. It's a global problem that we're trying to solve. So, you know, I'm working in the UK and I see the UK up close and personal, and I see how disastrous cancer care is in the UK. And that gets me to ask a question: what does it look like in the rest of the world? So is it just the UK that's out of step, or are these problems in the world? And I'm fortunate in my work that I communicate with many countries in the world, you know, Australia, America, right through Europe. And these are problems that are in the world. And these are problems that have been coming. You know, we spoke at the start about problems being magnified. Well, certainly they are magnified with COVID. And I believe that all nations, not just the UK, I mean, I'm very critical of what's happening here by the UK government and by the NHS, who basically work for the government. But I see it in America, you know, where they've got totally different angle of care. Cancer care is very way down the list in terms of COVID. And, you know, it's just not right what is happening throughout the world for people affected by cancer. It's just not right. They are being sacrificed on the altar of COVID, as I call it. And as we all know, unfortunately, cancer is something that won't wait. It won't wait for us. And I know personally now, you know, I know a lot of doctors and I know a lot of nurses in the UK, and I know people that are dying now and having treatment that's not their best options, because that's the only treatment available for them. So that's why I'm angry. I'm angry because this problem, we could foresee that. As soon as we left cancer alone, this problem was going to come. And I'm angry because no government, I don't think any government in the world, is actually focused on cancer right now, and particularly our government, it certainly isn't.
And can you exemplify what kind of main problems you identified in the UK?
Yeah, I could exemplify that simply by, I mean, I've had conversations this week, we're on Thursday, and I have had conversations with people about their personal treatment every single day of the week. And I know a lady, I spoke to a lady yesterday who was going for breast cancer. She went with a friend of hers who is a nurse, and she was offered chemotherapy where in normal circumstances they would have done surgery for her. But we're not in normal circumstances. The surgery is not a possibility for quite some months. So she's now having to go in on a regime that's A, not the first effective for her, not the best. It's not the best option. And therefore her quality of life will be impacted. And who knows whether she will actually survive what she's going through, survive her diagnosis or not. But she certainly isn't having the best start to her cancer diagnosis that she could expect, or she should expect, from this country. You know, we have what we call, laughingly now, we have a National Health Service. But quite frankly, if you turn up almost anywhere with anything that's not COVID related, you will be pushed back politely, by the way, by the people on the front line.
And why didn't your contact person didn't get the surgery? What was the reason?
Because the waiting list was too long.
Okay. All right. And then there are no alternatives in any other hospitals?
No, because the situation is the same in every hospital. One of the hospitals I was talking to a cancer CNS. They apparently had four theatre slots for cancer. And now that's gone down to two. So basically they're doing half the number of cancer surgeries. That's in London.
Okay. And frustration. Wow.
Frustration. It's more than frustration.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm in a way, I'm lucky because I'm actually in the system, and, you know, I'm well known in the hospital that I'm at, and God forbid, I think anything happens to me personally, I'm sure I would be in the queue, you know, but I wouldn't like to be now newly diagnosed with cancer at this stage now, because there just isn't the capacity to deal with the numbers.
And do you think it's a systemic problem, or is that on the individual basis that physicians, for instance, don't dare to try to find alternatives, or isn't really that the people are not able to do anything about that?
No, it's 100% is systemic. The NHS has been poorly run for many, many years, but we haven't been found out simply because we haven't had what we've had now, which is COVID, right? So the ideal scenario would have been we would be dealing with COVID, but cancer and any other serious condition, you know, Alzheimer's, heart problems, I'm not just banging the gong for cancer, but they would have to be dealt with as well, of course, right? And there should have been some plans in place. Look, nobody could have predicted the pandemic. I'm not being clever in advance, but, you know, we didn't even have the PPE, which we should have had in the first place, because there have been cuts by series of governments, doesn't matter, politicians, any colour, red, blue, green, pink, any colour of politician, all they want to do is cut what's going on with the NHS. And now we've got what we've got. The government basically are the employers of the NHS. The NHS is a very closed regime. They don't like anybody talking out. They talk about people who talk out as whistleblowers. Quite frankly, in private business, you know, we would all talk about difficult times in a business. And why shouldn't the employees, if they've got something that they think can be improved, why shouldn't they talk to their line managers? Why shouldn't they talk to their CEO where they can see things that can be improved? Why are they called whistleblowers? You know what I mean? The system within the health service is averse to change, first of all. It's frightened of change. So they put their shields up, and we protect the NHS, as Boris Johnson would say. Well, actually, what have we done? We've protected the NHS, but for what reason? Because now we need them. They can't do anything for us, right? So we've wonderfully protected this organisation, but actually now they can't help us. So it's very systemic. I mean, basically, healthcare in this country specifically, hasn't even kept up with the wonders of technology. You know, even let's say GP appointments on Zoom, you know, it's hardly groundbreaking, is it? Let's be honest. But there was a big GP appointments on Zoom. Oh, no, we can't have that. You know what I mean? Initially from GPs as well as patients. But this is progress. We've been given technology to improve things. But if we as human beings can't use that technology in the right way, you know, the world is improving. You can buy at any age, you can buy your shopping. You know, it can be coming through your door. With the big guys, it comes through the next day or even the same day sometimes, right? But the health service is getting worse with technology. I don't understand it. Really, I don't understand it. I know what it is, because they're frightened. They're frightened of what technology can do.
Or isn't it also that the money is spent differently? That companies, for instance, like, let's say, Amazon, they know how to spend their money. And if it's coming to communities, politics, it's always a big discussion. We try to discuss the finance democratically, but then somehow it filters off, and no one really understood where the money was spent.
Nico, the money angle of that, of healthcare in general, not just cancer, you know, healthcare in general, the money angle to me is always a red herring. Because whenever you talk to a politician, they'll say straight away, we've given cancer care 100 billion, right? Fantastic, you know, but actually, what has that 100 billion done? What have we done with that money? What actually has been achieved by giving some a service some money? You know, we want to know what's happened to the money, not you've given the money. It needs to be sustainable. And the things that I talk about in the work I do, I'm not talking about spending another penny in cancer care currently. I'm not talking about buying more robots to do surgery. I'm not talking about having more consultants. I'm talking about using the ones we've got so much better, so much more efficiently. You know, even an appointment letter, something as basic as that, they can't get right. It goes through three or four different departments. It gives the wrong information. It cancels appointments when you should be there. Even the basics of cancer care are not there. They're just not there. The basics, getting a letter, you know, something as basic as that. We can't do that properly.
It's somehow funny, but also very tragic, because here, since last year, we have this big impression in Germany that everyone looks at the UK. Everyone talks about the vaccines, and there's always news when UK opens up again and changes something. And big virologists here, they say, look at the UK. The data there are working, they are good, we can trust the data that come from them. And your picture is quite different. That's why it's important to talk to people who really live there, I think.
I mean, I agree. I talk, you know, I don't get my information from a newspaper or from the television. You know, let's be fair, there's a lot of dodgy information spinning around, certainly on social media, you know, but I get my information from talking to people in those countries. And Nico, it's quite interesting what you say. You're 100% right about the vaccinations, 100% right. In my opinion and my knowledge, I think we're the best in the world, what we've done for vaccinations. And that's one of the positives that I would say from the service, from the government, maybe a bit of luck thrown in the pot because we've made a lot of bad decisions. That was one of the good ones. And we're able to open up now, not fully, but we have the economy moving. So that was a good move. And I think we should be praised for that without any doubt. That's been the best decision so far of this. But that, if you take the rest of it away, it didn't really make logical sense why almost every other condition has been left as a sacrifice to what we've been doing there. I guess if you'd have carried on doing the care on other areas, it might have been difficult to do all the vaccinations we've done. I understand. It's a problem of capacity. I understand that we never had enough capacity in the first place to deal with it. That's 100% for sure. But certain issues in healthcare, obviously including cancer, are not going to get better. You know, the people are getting worse. And with the GP scenarios we've had, you know, a lot have been not closed, but not very welcoming, should we say, to people who would want to go there to show them their lumps and bumps. And a lot of people have got fed up with trying to get appointments, so they feel very vulnerable, they don't bother, and therefore we get later diagnosis, which therefore leads to more stage four, less people can be cured anyway, you know, in normal circumstances.
Let me ask another question, because I think your power of your voice comes really from your experience. And you've been there, you were diagnosed with cancer. And maybe if it's possible, can you describe how things changed for you before and after diagnosis? Do you have this kind of timeline where you think before and after? What is that how it felt, or was it just another step?
No, it wasn't just another step. it was life-changing. I mean, I'd never been in my personal instance. I won't spend too long on my personal scenario, but in my personal instance, I was 51. And I had some problems with tonsils and stuff. And that's where they diagnosed me with cancer. And when they told me, I was stage four, and they said, I've got 6 months to live. So, you know, I'd been healthy for 50, up to 51. You know, I'd worked ever since the age of 16, never took a day off sick, never, because I love what I do and I was healthy. So when I was suddenly sat down and told that I'd only got 6 months to live, it was a massive, massive, massive shock. I can't tell you the shock it was. And look, so I had to go through chemotherapy. I went through stem cell transplant, and all of these were steps. There was no guarantees. First of all, there was no guarantee that they could find a match for me. There was no guarantee that I would survive the chemotherapy because it was very aggressive. There was no guarantee that I would make anything anywhere. Just we go one step, one step, one step, one step. But eventually, when I went through all that lot and I came out, I survived the transplant. So that was my first ambition, if you like, was to survive the transplant. And I did. I was lucky enough to survive the transplant. But that's where my life really changed and was never, ever the same, because I became a passenger in my own life. And I'm a leader by my nature. That's the, you know, I've run my own business. I've always worked for myself since I was very young. So to be told by clinicians, nurses, my wife, you know, don't do this, do this, don't do this. This was a big, massive adjustment to my life. But what hurt me more was that society wanted to discriminate against me when I came out. And that was the biggest thing I remember, and is what has stimulated me to do the work that I currently do. I believed naively now, as it turns out, I believed that some charity was going to be able to pick me up and it was going to be able to look after me. It was going to tell me how I could pay my mortgage because I wasn't earning any money. I was self-employed, right? It was going to tell me how I could do the basics of life, let's say, how I could find a job, because I couldn't work for myself. My health was, you know, unreliable, to say the least. But actually, no, I didn't find that. I didn't find that. All those people who talk very loudly on the TV when they're asking for money, actually, they don't do what they say they're going to do. And there was no practical help. All they wanted to do was give me a booklet. I mean, I've got the disease, so I didn't really want to learn any more about it. All they gave me was a load of booklets. And really, I felt embarrassed because there was nothing really they could do. Bearing in mind, this was 14 years ago, right? So things have changed a little bit. But the discrimination side of it hasn't changed. And in fact, actually, with COVID, it's getting worse. So the discrimination I found was with my bank. Basically, they wanted to talk about mortgage payments and things like that. They wouldn't lend any. I mean, I didn't need it, but they wouldn't have lent to me any more money because I wasn't working. I was self-employed and I was a big risk of cancer, right? So trying to find a job in England, you have to tick a box that says cancer, you have a disability, because cancer in the UK is a registered disability, right? So you have to tick the box. And the design of that was so that you weren't discriminated against. But of course, all employers look at that box and go, oh, right, he's got long-term cancer, and they throw your application in the bin, right? So basically, if you want to go on holiday, you know, they want to charge as much for holiday insurance as they did for the holiday. If you want any form of insurance, even down to car insurance, because you've got cancer, you're on drugs, they want to put the price up. So everywhere I went, I found discrimination. I didn't want pity. I wanted help. And not just me. I mean, I'm quite capable of sorting things out, right? It's not a big thing for me. But there's plenty of very, very, very vulnerable people that don't have wonderful families, don't have incredible friends, don't have the groups that I have. And I work for them, because the system should look after the weak as much as it should for the strong, right? And it doesn't do that. It doesn't do that. So yes. I was very, very upset about how society, I'm not talking about NHS, because NHS are doing their job. They're keeping me alive, right? But society, this is a society issue. People who are disabled, and we have many forms of disability, as you well know, not just cancer, right? There are many, many disabilities. I can say at least 60%, maybe 70% of those people are unable to get a regular job. And I don't mean 40 hours a week, but I mean something they can do regularly, even if it's one day a week. So society almost puts you on the side that you're finished at whatever age you are, because it's very difficult to come back when you have cancer attached to your name.
There's so much in it what you just described. Let me just maybe dissect that with the first question, with the last personal question, and then we dig into the kind of systemic things. Because I think what's really important, at least for me, it was when I started medicine and I dealt with diagnoses who usually are associated with mortality and very early mortality. As you said, you were told to only live at maximum 6 months. And for now, for the last, what was it now, 14 years, right?
14 years, yeah, correct.
You basically lived, I cannot describe that any differently. Forgive me that it's too clumsy, but you kind of lived with death and with the announcement of relapse and another change, another part that completely could change your whole life. What does that mean to you? How do you have a coping strategy you developed over the years, or is it just you kind of setting aside and just do my everyday job and try to not think about it? How do you deal with that?
No, it was a thank you, and that wasn't clumsy at all. So the early days of that were very difficult, because I was in and out of hospital so frequently. I had very serious GVHD on four occasions, I think, where I needed hospitalisation. The last one, I needed 3 years of apheresis. So that was going up for specialist treatment every fortnight for 2 days of 3 years of that, right? So that became very difficult. You know, every time I got better, which took time, of course, because your body takes time to recover. Once you've had transplant, your immune system's no good, and everything takes longer to function. After that, it took me about 5 or 6 years to reach a level of acceptance, if you like. You know, I'm a strong boy physically and mentally, and that nearly broke me, I must be honest. It nearly broke me. And I did need some psychological support, which I found at the hospital, because I felt that I was never getting out of this spiral of getting better, getting worse, getting better, getting worse. And I thought, if this is going to be my life, you know, I don't want to carry on like this, because it's like someone opens the window and then shuts it again. You know, you can see all the nice things you can do, but then you can't do them because another problem comes. So it took me about 5 years to do that, but I needed a focus, because I have a business mind. I said to you, I run a business before cancer, and the only thing that I could really think of that I wanted to do was, fortunately, I don't have to work for money. I don't have to. I'm lucky like that. You know, I earned reasonably well. My wife, she's retired now, so we have an income. So I don't have to do anything in particular, but so I chose to help people like me, if you like, that would find the problems that I found. And not only that, I wanted to help the people that were providing the service because, you know, if you're running a rubbish restaurant, you want people to tell you, don't you? You don't want them just not to come back, right? You want them to say, actually, this is not right, what you're doing for me. You know, you need to do it like this. So I wanted to help both parties. So I didn't know anything about websites or social media, or, you know, I'm from the old generation where you pick up the phone to people, you know? So when they said, oh, go on the website, make a website, I didn't know what the hell they were talking about. So my friends very kindly set me up a website, not the one I have today, but that's developed. And so is all my social media, that's developed with only my experience. So I got to the level of acceptance with my situation. And what that did was, purely by my luck, really, I think, it empowered me. It took all my fear because, you know, I wasn't frightened of dying. Once someone tells you you're going to die, you know, you sort of start making mental plans for it. But it was more difficult, actually, to make mental plans for staying alive because it was such a surprise. Nobody expected it, and it was a crazy thing. So it... After that sort of period, I felt empowered by it because, you know, I'd been seriously ill for a long time and I'd been on the jaws of death a few times. You know, there were times when my wife went home and she didn't know if I was going to be alive in the morning. There were things like that. So we've seen it. And now there's nothing for me to be frightened of, right? Nothing frightens me in life, really. It never really did, but now it certainly doesn't. So that gave me the confidence. I've always had confidence, as you can probably tell, but it gave me the confidence to do the work I do now and not to bother whether anyone agrees with me, disagrees with me. I speak from my personal experience, not what I've read in the paper, not what someone's told me, but what I've actually seen.
And how did you start then? You started about talking about your website and your blog. And could you just describe how you started, how it evolved, and maybe just say, if you now look back, like 14 years ago, it's quite a lot of time. I mean, 14 years ago, I was 16.
You're lucky, man.
what changed? Were there things that worsened over the years, in your opinion, that made you more angry, or what did improve? How did the whole thing
evolve? Okay, so the blog, So the blog evolved simply because, yes, I was getting frustrated because when I was in my business, you know, when we go to work, Nico, we feel that we are something. I don't mean we overestimate our self-importance, but we have a value somewhere. You know, you're part of a team, you make things happen, you do certain things that other people can't do, and you achieve something, right? You every day you go to work to do your best, you achieve something, and at the end of the day, you get rewarded financially by the person who you work for. So we're all used to that sort of system. And when that's taken away, you know, I was in my business, I was one of the best in my business, and my phone didn't stop ringing. Communication's my thing, right? So I communicated, I then had customers all around the world. So I was flying all over the place to sell goods and come back to the UK. So communication is my thing. And I was frustrated with my illness because people asked me to talk, to come to their talks. You know, a few little charities started asking me. They said, you've got interesting views. Would you like to come be our patient guest? Da, da, da. And some I was able to do and some I wasn't because I wasn't well at the time. And I didn't like that because I like to be professional and I like to turn up when I say I'm going to be there and do things I say I'm going to do. So that's when my friend said, well, do it on the website because you can communicate you know, have a website, communicate your thoughts, and even when you're not feeling well, you can do it from home. So I said, okay, that's when they started it for me. And then once we started the website, they said, oh, well, you need to tell people you exist. So you have to go on Twitter, you have to go on Facebook and all of these other things, right? So that was all a new experience. And actually, I love change as it happens. I love it. I thrive on change. And so that was, for me, was all new. You know, I didn't know about the internet. I didn't know about all of those things. So I had to learn as I was going along, right? It wasn't that I had a teacher here. I had to learn what worked, what didn't work. And with your blog, you know, when you start a blog or a website and you do your first post, you know, you press that button and you think, where's that gone? You know, is there anyone out there? You know, is there anyone listening to me? Are they gonna read this? And it was quite funny, you know, they did read it. And very quickly, I would say, in the scheme of it all, you know, from never being known at all who I was or anything, having no background in cancer, nothing, or healthcare, I won. I was voted in 2014, so that was a bit of time ago now, the UK Health Blogger of the Year, which was unbelievable. You know, I'd never written anything since I was 15. Right? And here I was in my 50s starting to write things that people enjoyed. So it was great. Through that, I've won various different awards. And it just moved on and progressed, more followers. And now I'm in a position where, you know, I get to meet a lot of fancy people. If you look on my website, you'll see the people that I get to meet. We always like to put a photo up there. You know, I'm unfortunately involved in politics in a light touch way. You know, some of the politicians of the UK, they know me. I've met a few previous prime ministers. So the whole thing has snowballed, if you like, to now that now people listen to what I say. I guess I'm in the position where I wanted to be, that people know who Chris Lewis is. People listen to what Chris Lewis has to say. And now I'm in the position that I can try my very best to force change.
And you have also this project called Simpal, is that correct?
Simpal. Yeah, that's a UK charity indeed. I do, sorry.
No, please maybe describe what it is, what the idea was, and yeah.
Okay, so if I'm honest, I wasn't looking for any more work because, you know, the cancer takes up 24/7 pretty much my life, either my personal cancer or the work that I do. And I'm also trying to write a book at the same time anyway, I'm trying to write a book. So 4 years ago, it was just over 4 years ago, I was approached. So I'm known for innovation in cancer. I'm known for looking at new ideas and wanting to change, you know, the old ways of working. We've done the old ways of working for my knowledge at least 50 years and nothing's changed, right? So we should give up with that and we should at least try something new. So I was looking for new ways of practically helping people, not just from a distance through my website, but you know, maybe face-to-face and stuff like that. And I was approached, as I say, at least 4 years ago it was, by my partner in Simpal, a lady called Blair. And she rang me one day and she said, look, she wanted to come and see me speak, but that was sold out. But she said, could I meet you privately? Because my family's been affected by cancer and I run a mobile phone business. And I'd like to see if there's anything that we can do together to help people affected by cancer. So I hadn't even thought about it and I didn't really want to run another charity because I had plenty to do already. But we talked about it and we knew what we call cancer poverty. So when we know that a lot of, through my own experience, that people with cancer lose their jobs, a lot of them, and you know, digital communication was really coming to the fore then, let's say four or five years ago. And I knew so many people that couldn't afford to even have a mobile phone. You know, it was a choice of putting food on the table or a mobile phone. So we came up with the idea that we'd like to provide people affected by cancer with a mobile and 6 months of free calls, data, etc. Some don't need a free phone because some have a pay-as-you-go or whatever it is. So in which case we could just give them a SIM card. And I didn't know how that would go, really. I didn't know what problems we'd find, but we tried it with a few small local charities who are friends of mine. And I said, look, this is the scheme we want to do. Can you give some away to your people? And let's just try. We give it away and see what happens. And it became very successful. So we knew we needed to raise money to do it. And we knew that we had to be a registered charity to do it. So we became a registered charity called SimPal. And so for 4 or 5 years now, we've been, as far as we can financially, helping people affected by cancer. And that's not just people who have cancer directly. That involves also their family, friends, relatives, because, you know, sometimes if someone's on their own, right, they might want to take their sister, brother, son, whatever. And those people don't always have a phone. So we wanted people to be able to communicate at the time they needed it most, without having to worry, you know, I need to top it up and all of this business. We wanted to take that away from them for 6 months, just so they could try and focus on getting better or whatever the case was. So I was delighted that we are the only people in the world that do this project, right? So we get calls all the time from Australia, America. They all want us to do something, but we can't. It's difficult enough to do it in the UK. So we're the only people who do it. Why? Because there's no money in it. But what happens is that we came to the fore during COVID because everybody found out about digital poverty, right? Not just cancer poverty. We found out about digital poverty and all the kids and families that don't have 4 or 5 iPads sitting around. They don't have super broadband that copes with what they need. So that came to the fore, and we ended up helping some old age pensioners people and some people with Alzheimer's and stuff like that during COVID, which was a little bit outside our expertise, but we worked with specific partners to do that. So that's what we're known for, and we're the only people in the world that do it. We don't advertise much, so most people listening to this will go, who? We don't advertise much because basically we're full up. We work on recommendation only. We know, we work with Maggie's, the Macmillan Centres, the nurses on the ground. I don't work with NHS Direct. I don't work with Macmillan Direct. I don't work with Cancer Research Direct because all those people are hurdles to progress. They only want to stop you. They don't want to encourage you with new project. They only want to put up a barrier for it. So we work directly with the nurses on the ground. We work with Citizens Advice. We work with people coming into the country that English is not their first language. So we've got homeless people with cancer. We help all those people. Well, not all of them, but, you know, subject to the money that we can get in. So it's a way of giving something back practically, if you like, rather than me sitting just behind the machine and writing a blog. I can actually do something practical for people to change their life, because every phone, you know, you can get a phone these days, 40, 50 quid. You know, that's drinking money for some people. You know, they'll spend that in the pub. But this changes people's lives. You know, to give them a phone, this is absolutely life-changing. So for me to do something as simple as that, it's just an incredible feeling for us. We don't have any paid staff. There are 4 of us volunteers. We have a simple system. 90% of the money raised goes out. 10% covers our exes. That's it.
That's impressive. And it's also the kind of feeling when I'm listening to you is the same what you just told me at the beginning, and which completely resonates with me, is your experience with this feeling of discrimination in every level, in banking and let's say finding a parking place for your car, etc. Do you have any idea or projects to, or do you think that this kind of discrimination can be tackled in any way, or is it just huge projects, a small grassroots project, or is it does it need a systemic approach to go to the government and say, okay, we don't need this kind of disability card for cancer people, let's try to find something more differentiated? Or
I know what you're asking, and if you were asking me this question 3 years ago, I would have said we need to go to the government. But you're asking it to me now, when the world has changed. And if I'm honest with you, I don't believe that any government in the world, and I'm generalizing now, but with everything they've got to do with COVID, I don't believe it's in their interest to solve this problem. I don't believe a social problem. There are many social problems, right? Let's be fair. Poverty being a big one, okay? Which is never going to be solved. Never. In fact, COVID has accelerated poverty everywhere in the world. You know, we now have a two-class system almost, where people get medication and other people don't. You know, we've already got that. We see that in this country. So I think my answer, my honest answer to you is, yes, it needs systemic work. But what I found with what I do is that actually one man, and I'm not taking the credit for this, because I have a big community behind me and I have a lot of players but we are making a difference. People know we're there. Let's put it like that. People know we're there. The big charities know we're there. The government know we're there. People know I'm there, you know, and they know me all around the world. They know me, what I'm doing. So I'm not saying I could change the world. I only wish I could, but I can't. That's too big a deal for me. But I don't believe that it's in the government's interest, if I'm honest, because wherever you go, in life, if you want something to change from what it currently is, you have to show the person who's in charge of that area, whatever it may be, what they're going to get from that change, because undoubtedly change can be uncomfortable at times, right? Because certain old ways have to go by the board and we have to do new things in a different way. A lot of people don't like change. So you have to actually show to the people how their lives can be improved by the changes that you want to make, right? So for me, society, now we've seen COVID, so we have more long-term disability. We'll have long COVID now to add to that list. We've already got a situation currently where we don't have enough workers in certain places to do the jobs now. Because with either Brexit or with COVID, we don't have the people in the areas that we need them now, right? So my answer to that, I'm not just a critic of what people do. I'm not that person. I want to provide answers, not just find problems. My answer to that is open your eyes wide. There is a massive community of people with disability that want to work. No, they might not necessarily want to go and pick vegetables in a field for 12 hours in a day, right? But 2 or 3 days a week, they might be able to use their marketing skills or whatever other skills they've got. We've now found ways of working that we can work from home, right? Flexible working, hybrid working, whatever you want to call it. So we've now found new ways of working where we don't all pack on a train, you know, at 8 o'clock in the morning and we all walk like sheep and come back at 5 at night. You know, thank God all that working way is out the window. But now we need to look at different ways of working to embrace the people that have disability, because the cancer numbers, Nico, right? The cancer numbers, they've gone from one in three to one in two rapidly. So in the UK alone, we have 60 million people plus. 30 million people in this country will be impacted by cancer at some stage in their life. Right? Now, I can't believe that if that's not a social problem, I don't know what is. Half the nation. You know, look what we've lost. I don't know. Every death is bad. But with COVID, we've lost 160,000 people plus. Right? Mm. But we're losing 450 people a day from cancer and nobody even mentions it. Yeah. It's not even mentioned. It's not on anyone's agenda.
Yeah, and it's impressive that things get quite loose and decisions are made quite quickly when there's some kind of urgent problem. But problems that are always urgent and always big, but tend to not just arrive in December 2020 or in December 2019, then this huge difference. So,
yeah, I mean, we've seen the worst of you know, I've never seen nothing like that in my time. You know, I'm 65 now, right? My mother and father lived through the war, Second World War. And I don't think it's anything like that. Very, very different scenario. It's impacted because the world's so close now. We're all one world. You know, we've got that communication. So whatever happens in one place, it's going to happen everywhere because that's how it is. And what it's shown us, definitely, you're right, is that we can work together when the need is there. We can do it. It's shown us. We now have history that says this is achievable, right? So what I don't get is now let us do this with cancer. Okay, that's the biggest killer in the world, I think, cancer. But we've been happy just to those people that are dying or disabled, just put them to one side and we'll carry on because they can't fight back. They're not noisy people. You know, most of them die anyway in 2 or 3 years' time. This is the way that society views, and it's wrong.
Yeah. What are your current and future goals? And did COVID affect your work? Did you change something, or did you approach something differently?
So we'll start with the COVID change first. Yeah. COVID did affect me because my website and my work is all about cancer. And when COVID came, you know, it was like really like a bolt out of the blue, and the way it took hold so quickly. And I thought to myself, no one wants me moaning on about cancer, right? No one's interested in cancer, nobody. Even the people who had it were more interested in COVID, right? So I thought, actually, what am I going to do about this? But like I said to you, I like change. So I thought about it and I thought, actually, what's happened now? We've got plenty of people working from home that have never done that before. We've got people with families that are all together because the kids are not going to school. We've got everybody in a different situation to what they were, right? So everyone's living in unique times. So I opened my blog up and I said, look, this is for anyone. Doesn't matter, cancer, no cancer. Anyone who's having a tough time or wants to just tell something to the rest of the world, come on. And I'll feature your piece. Just write it. Doesn't matter you're a professional writer or not. I'll get it, you know, suitable for you. So we did that for about 2 months. And it was very popular, actually. I must admit, it was popular. It was popular from the people who were writing because they'd never had any pieces published. It was a new thing for them. And it was a really positive focus. And it was a great focus for, I got a lot of followers basically from the NHS, from doctors, because I featured some of the nurses who were going through, you know, different experiences at hospital, PPE, all of those sort of things. And then, so after that few months, then of course, we were still ignoring cancer. And then the cancer word started to come back about what are we doing about cancer? So then I was straight back onto cancer and have been busier ever since. So we had that little period with COVID where we gave a lot of people an opportunity to share their thoughts about what was happening. So that was nice. It was nice for me to give new people a chance and just to see a little picture of what was going on elsewhere outside of cancer. My goals, you talk about my goals. Well, basically, I've had one simple goal in my personal life, and that's always been to be better tomorrow than I was today. And that applies very much. I want to write better pieces. I want to have bigger impact in what I'm doing. I want to have more influence in what I'm doing. And I want to help more people. You know, it's as simple as that. I'm not here to earn money. I don't earn money from doing this. I earn money elsewhere. I do corporate speaking and corporate writing where I get paid to do that for other people. That's fine. But this work is solely about helping people. If I can help individual people affected by cancer, family members, my story helps people through the internet. You know, I'm lucky now because my story, my case is a rare one with the disease I have, which is mantle cell lymphoma. If you Google that, you don't find too many that have gone as far as I've gone. And so it's great to hear from others that have found my story on the internet and they found it quite empowering, let's say, to know that when they've been diagnosed, it won't necessarily kill them. You know, that there is a possibility that they can have a better result than maybe they're thinking. So in a short answer, just really to help as many people as I can, really.
And coming to the end, I've got two questions. One, another personal one, if that's even possible for you, or I don't know if you, since 2007, if you ever did that. Do you have plans for, like, let's say, do you look over 1 year for what you want to accomplish or what you want to see, what you want to do?
Not really. To be honest, I wasn't a great planner because life, you know, I used to think I was in control of life. You know, we all do. We think we're in control of our life, right? But actually, when you analyze it, Nico, there's so many things that are out of your control. So, you know, you've got a career path, I'm sure you have, but you know, the government can change, COVID can come, you're working from home, you know, God forbid you get an illness or anything like that can happen to you. So my answer is I have a direction of travel, so I want to go forward, but I don't really make big plans because of my health, you're right. I don't go even a year. I do maybe 6 months probably is the most. My biggest ambition is to finish my book simply because my book is my legacy and I will be able to help a lot more people when I'm gone through my book. It's not a book specifically of cancer. It's a book of overcoming personal hurdles in your life, and which we all have them, right? So that's what my book's about, and it will definitely help a lot of people. So that's my first ambition, is to finish that job. I'm about halfway through, but the problem is I'm still making chapters. So somewhere I have to stop and say, you know, this book finishes in 2021. So yeah, that's my ambition. Look, I've done a lot in my life. I've been fortunate. You know, I've traveled the world with my work. I've traveled the world with my kids. I live in a nice house. You know, life is as good as it can be for me. You know what I mean? I'm just grateful every day. And look, it's not, it's it's not meant to sound cheesy, but I'm grateful for every day. You know what I mean? I've got three wonderful grandkids that I would never have seen. You know, they've all come since my diagnosis. And I'm seeing my kids now achieve, my grandkids achieve things. I'm seeing my boys achieve stuff. And I'm a very proud man. So, you know, if it all ended for me tomorrow, I would be happy, because I've been lucky and I've had 14 years I never expected, right? And I've been able to do things. You know, I've been around the world with cancer. You know, I've talked in some of the biggest cancer congresses in the world. So I've done things I would never have imagined. I've got friends that are very powerful people, high profile sportsmen, stuff like that. I've got friends of that who I would never have met if it wasn't through my cancer. So cancer's taken a lot for me, no doubt about that. It's taken a lot for me. My health is poor, despite what you see here. My health is poor, but it's given me a lot of other stuff in return. You know, I can't say I'm glad I got cancer. I would have been happy carrying on my old life, you know, and I probably would have had a heart attack with the stress. But you know, it's taken away my choices, because when you've got good health, you have choice, right? Of vaguely according to your financial situation, but you have choice on what you do with your life. I don't have much choice in certain circumstances, but I can't keep moaning about it, because life is what it is. You know, it's dealt me a set of cards, and those are the only cards which I've got. So it's up to my skill to play those cards in the best way that I can.
And in the end, let me start first with a kind of description and with a characterization of you, and because I think you're a very unique person for your, let's say, for your generation, because I think that change really, if change needs to be systemic, as we talked about, the new generation, the younger generation, needs to realize that. And maybe use you as a kind of an idol, or like as one who could show the way. But we who live like the next 40, 50, 60 years need to go all the way and need to also change, maybe give refinements, etc. And what would you say, what is important for the young generation of physicians who treat or who will treat cancer patients? What do you think is really important for us to bear in mind, to try to think about, to try to dare asking, that this change that you kind of visualize for yourself and for your community really is realized?
That's a great question, Nico, actually. And it's quite a simple answer. It's not as technical as you might think, quite frankly. So I'll take you back to what I was talking about and one of the basic problems. And it's not just cancer care, by the way. This is healthcare in general, is communication. Okay. So we have a problem now currently because generally of the older generation of physicians, clinicians, you know, doctors, they were brought up, and it's no blame, it's systemic again, it's systemic, that those people were treated as gods, if you like, within the profession, right? So by their colleagues, peers, and also by us, the patients. You know, we were, it's my generation, I'm grateful to see the GP. You know, I'm pleased that he was able to spare time with me, as I am with my cancer doctors. But it's not like that anymore. You know, we shouldn't be grateful. Well, sorry, I don't mean we should be grateful. We are grateful. But we don't need to see these guys as gods. These guys are fellow human beings. So it's not an us and a them. It's us all together. So doctors are also human beings. So rather than oh, you know, bed three, he's got lymphoma, or bed two, he's leukemia, right? It's not like that. In bed three is Mr. Lewis, it's Chris, right? What does he do for a living? Oh, he sells whatever he does. Right, so in Chris's instance, what does success look like? Because success is different for all of us, right? From a clinician perspective, from a patient perspective. So success at that time, in my time, was staying alive. I am successful, right? I'm personally successful, and so is my clinician, because he's achieved success because he's kept me alive, right? And I'm happy I'm alive. So we've both achieved success. But these days, we need more than staying alive. More people, as you well know, are surviving cancer now, living with cancer. And that's a positive thing, right? But the negative thing, as we spoke earlier, is society. Society doesn't really like us there. So what we need to do is have stronger conversations with our clinicians, not only about surviving, but about what we might be able to do afterwards, after surviving. Right? Not just sitting in our bedroom looking out the window for 5 years. that's not success. So, you know, if I'm a lorry driver, or if I'm a computer analyst or something, you know what I mean? We all need different things. And if what you're going to do to me is going to stop me driving lorries or whatever I do, then maybe we should be having a conversation about that. Right? Maybe I might not like you doing that to me.
Yeah.
So the simple answer, really, Nico, is much better communication. I think, if I'm honest, that's beginning to happen now with the younger generation, because I see much better engagement from clinicians on social media. I see that. I'm sure you see that yourself. The Americans started it, obviously, because they're selling a product. They want customers, right? So that's why they started it. But UK's not bad now. You know, most trusts are on Twitter or whatever. They've got websites, and a lot of doctors and clinicians are now as well. So I believe that's coming. But I also believe that we must be, as patients, no age limit here, but all of us, we must be more proactive in our own care. So we don't just rely on the clinician. We don't just sit there and soak it up, what you give me. We want to have a dialogue.
Yeah.
So it's a simple thing, really. If we improve communication throughout the world, honestly, things would be so, so much easier. And, you know, we look at us as human beings, instead of, you know, carrying around a dozen case notes. You know, oh, hold on, I've got a blue one here. What does this mean? He's got this. You know, I better hurry, look at him. You know, we're all human beings. And what I would say to clinicians is reverse the role sometimes and analyze it. You know, sometimes, look, it's difficult talking to different people, giving them all different news, right? I don't envy the job of a cancer clinician or a CNS. I don't envy that job, because some people are giving good news, some people are giving bad news, and we all accept news in a different way, right? Mm. All of us, you know. Some people, it doesn't trickle in. Some people it does. Some people are emotional, some people are not. So that's a skill in itself, having those meetings. That's a skill. Forget the clinical skill, the actual communication skill is something. And that, personally, I believe that that's something throughout healthcare is not focused on enough, actually. It's great you know your stuff. I'm very happy. you know what you're doing to me. But actually, you know, the basics of communication from nurses, doctors, from receptionists in the clinic, you know, it could be so much better.
Yeah, and I think because that was a moment where I got kind of a bit frustrated or a bit of angry inside of me, is when you said that a physician told you have 6 months. And I'm personally, I'm really try to avoid that, because I'm can imagine that, okay, in that moment, it's a complete disaster for the patient who hears this, because, okay, well, what does that mean in the next 6 months? How will the next 6 months look like? And when you look back now after 14 years, you could ask yourself, okay, well, how accurate was that prediction, right? And to feel, I think that is the thing that you mentioned, is if we enable broader communication, we also need to show more insecurity or more acceptance of what we may not know for sure, and how we communicate this insecurity, this gap of knowledge. And to say, for instance, your life expectancy is, I don't know, in the next 2 years, 40%. What does that mean? What does that mean to you as a patient? I think that's really important to ask ourselves as physicians.
I think, yeah, you're right. But I'd like to add to that point, to that point of view. So to my own instance, actually, the reason the 6 months came about was that, so he said, you've got mantle cell lymphoma stage 4, right? And I said, what on earth is that? Because, you know, I don't know what the hell it is. And he said, it's cancer. I said, okay. And I said, what is stage 4? And he said, there isn't any stage 5, right? So I said, then how long do you think I've got? The reason I asked that, because I wanted to know what I should be doing in that time, right? And he said to me, he said, there are so many factors in play, but he said, if it doesn't go well for you, you've got 6 months. He said, you might not take, you know, the chemo might not do its job. They might not find a match for you in stem cell. You might not survive the transplant. He said, so there are so many things. If those things don't go well for you, you've got 6 months. And I, if I'm honest with you, Nico, I was grateful for him to tell me that because I knew then the seriousness of what I was facing, if I only had those 6 months, what I needed to do before that time came. You know, the favourite one, get your affairs in order and all this, right? So I wanted to know from that perspective, and it wasn't like you said, you've only got 6 months to live. It wasn't delivered like that at all.
Yeah,
because I don't think he would have told me even if I hadn't have asked. But I said, I want an idea of how long I've got.
Yeah, but in that case, then it's right. Then it helped you structure or kind of realize what you're into right now. So, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, sure.
No, he didn't do it like you're talking about. You know, I'm sorry, Mrs. Smith. You know, you've got pancreatic cancer and you're only going to live for 3 months. No, it wasn't like that at all. He was very... He was very empathetic, the guy, you know, because I didn't even expect it, that news. I'd gone there to have my tonsils inspected. So when he told me I was dying of cancer, I was shocked.
Yeah, sure. Well, shall we end with a more positive message than shock and death?
you're running this show, but you know something, Nico, you're right about finishing on a positive, but you know something about if you want to solve a problem, okay, first of all, you have to know what the problem is, right? So if we don't talk about death and how long we're going to live and what is the quality of life, we're going backwards. Because we've already spoken about the importance of open communication, right? So we at least now are in a position where I know my parents weren't. Both my parents had cancer, right? And you know something? My mum, she had breast cancer. She never told her mum that she even had cancer. She went through cancer treatment, surgery, chemo, radiotherapy. She went through all that with me, but not her mum. She never told her mum. They couldn't talk about cancer in those days. So we've come a long way. You know, it was called the Big C And I think they thought you got it if you touched someone else that had it. You know, it was like that, right? So we've come a long way by talking about cancer and talking about death. And now I'm sure yourself, you're shocked. If you go on Twitter or any of them, you know, Instagram, you see stem cells hanging up on a holder, right? You see people having chemo in their chair, on their mobile phone. You know, you see all sites. People are proud to share now. So we've come a long way in terms of cancer communication. So you're right about finishing on death and stuff, but it's important to talk about.
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much for your time. Really, really appreciate it. I think this talk could go on and on and on for hours.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
No problem. No, it's really, I think there are so many questions, especially when the all the details, but I'm sure you will cover that all in your blogs, etc., because this whole fine intertwined communication system between physician, patient, family, the broader friendships, etc. It's so delicate, and I think you're completely right. It's worth communicating and discussing the issue and getting into dialogues to see how the reality really is. And I'm really, really thankful for your time and that you made this possible. And let's hopefully see each other sometime. But I must say, I'm not sure how you felt during COVID, but COVID for me and for our group has one big advantage, because then you actually think of who you talk to and how long you talk to and how intensive you talk to the people. And I think humans are capable of finding positives and advantages all over the place.
Actually, Nick, I'll end on this note, right? And that's important. And first of all, I want to say thank you, by the way, for inviting me on, because, you know, I love the work that you guys do, your group does particularly. I think it's vital that you get out to young people, because, let's be honest, that's where the future is, right?
Yeah.
And you guys are helping to take EBMT into a different era, because that's what's happening. And so I'm really honored that you invited me and that I can be part of this. And if this story helps people, you know, I'd be absolutely delighted. But your point about time is absolutely key. And you know how you can value somebody in your life. It's very simple now. It's by how much time they give you. Okay. If you look at some of your friends, and go away when you finish this call, and the ones who can't pick up the phones, the ones who text and don't call, you know, if they don't give you any of your time, that shows you your value in their life.
Yeah.
So, you know, your value is how much time people give to you. Not money, not gifts, nothing else. Is their time. Because time is the most valuable thing that we have. We always have less tomorrow than we have today. Not like money. Money, we can always get it. You can get more. But time is less tomorrow. So time is the real value in our life.
And I thank you for your time. It's really, really, I really appreciate it.
And, no, it's important, Nico. It's important we get the message out. And thank you for, you know, using your platform, if you like, to do what you're going to do with this interview. I don't know, but I'm sure you'll keep me informed. And it's just delightful to, if I can help someone with sharing.